How can we bring a sense of wonder into our everyday lives? For Craig Foster, the answer lies in the wildness of the natural world. Craig is a filmmaker who won the 2021 Best Documentary Oscar for My Octopus Teacher and has a long career filming and photographing the wonders of nature. Craig shares his adventures in the new book, Amphibious Soul, Finding the Wild in a Tame World. And he joins us now with five of his key insights.
I'm Craig Foster. I'm an author, filmmaker, and I work every day in ocean conservation with the Sea Change Project. My great passions are studying marine animals, human origins, and indigenous knowledge through direct immersion in the water, caves, and remote villages of Africa. My last full-length film was My Octopus Teacher. I'm going to share with you five of the key insights from my new book, Amphibious Soul, Finding the Wild in a Tame World. Just over a decade ago, I embarked on a unique journey. After 25 years on the road as a documentary filmmaker, I returned to the place of my birth, the Cape of Good Hope, and made the commitment to dive into the great African sea forest every day for at least 10 years in order to connect with my wildness. In this book, which I wrote after 12 years of diving every day, over 4,000 immersions, I share how my encounters with the incredible creatures of the great African sea forest not only helped me rewild, they would help me discover my amphibious soul. The word amphibious means to live a double life, part on land, part in water. But the word is also fresh with wildness and vulnerability. Amphibians like the Cape River frog who once took up residence in the pond behind my home are the most vulnerable class of all creatures on Earth because their skin is permeable and so any form of pollution or toxicity puts them in jeopardy. We humans are permeable too in our own way. The sufferings of nature seep into our beings, affecting our health, our souls, our psyches. We are all in danger of what's left of our wild hearts. I see the idea of an amphibious soul as a powerful metaphor for the human condition. We exist simultaneously in two worlds, one wild and one tame. The question driving me forward as I dove into the cold water each day was, could I reclaim my wildness in a world that wants me to stay tame? In Amphibious Soul, I reveal how the wild world answered that question for me and how it can for you too. The first insight. The wild is a miraculous healer. When I returned to the Cape of Good Hope, I was in deep need of healing. 25 years of filming on the road had been hard on my body. I'd spent weeks in hospitals, ill from parasites, picked up diving in the lakes of Malawi and Rwanda, and almost dead from cerebral malaria. Though I healed from these conditions, my immune system was still weak, and I was prone to frequent chest infections. Each time in my life when I've been most worn down, I felt a deep pull to spend time connecting with nature. If anything could heal me, it was this. The cold water of the sea forest was a great healer and a patient teacher. Taking my time and watching how my body responded was key. I started with short dives, then increased my time bit by bit. The cold immersions eventually supercharged my immune system. No longer was I plagued with frequent chest infections. The cold had nursed me back to health and brought with it a new sense of clarity and peace. As with any intoxicating substance, I've learned I must treat the cold with respect. But the benefits are undeniable and have inspired me to reflect upon the costs of comfort. What happens when society embraces a climate-controlled existence over an invigorating icy plunge? Can we learn to sit with our discomfort a bit longer? What insights await us on the other side? Our aversion to discomfort causes us to miss out on so much. After all, the pain is fleeting, and what lies on the other side of those first 3 minutes of feeling cold is a lifetime of wonder and discovery. Second insight. We can all learn to speak humanity's oldest language. Before my return to the ocean, I spent decades learning from the greatest land trackers in the world, skilled hunters and naturalists from Africa's indigenous hunter-gatherer cultures. During my time learning from the sand trackers of the Kalahari, I'd look at a paw print and perhaps be able to identify the difference between a primate and a big cat, whereas a master tracker like Ngate Kankebe or Karawa Langwani could tell me how long since the animal had passed, which direction it was going, and how much energy it had left. Ngate once shared how he was able to sense the presence of unseen animals in different parts of his body. He could feel the gemsbok, the lion, the leopard, the porcupine, as an itching, as heat rippling through his legs and back and chest. His body was a radar system tuned like an instrument to the animals he loved and tracked. I hoped I might use the teachings of these skilled trackers to develop my own method for tracking underwater. But I wasn't sure how. Underwater animal tracks are swept away in milliseconds. Sounds move differently. Smell is impossible for humans. And even on the clearest mornings, you can't see farther than a few feet away. And then one day I saw it. Sand stuck to a little trail of sticky slime that told me a sea snail had just walked this path. My first underwater track. Many more would follow, each deepening my connection to the marvelous creatures who call the sea forest home. Developing a personal tracking practice is something anyone can do, even if they live in a city. The secret is persistence. Returning to the same spots over and over again sharpens pattern recognition skills until the paw prints and bird calls become a language that you can speak. Following signs and tracks, using alarm calls and smells to find animals or avoid predators is what humanity has done since our beginnings. When we track, we feel alive, we feel present, we feel useful. We reignite something that has blazed inside of us since the beginning of time. Tracking is like talking with God, the San tracker Ngate Kankebe told me. This ancient art is a form of communication with nature that allows us to swim beneath the veil and pluck the stories of wild creatures to the surface. Third insight. Reconnecting to the wild is the antidote to burnout. Before my return to the Cape of Good Hope, my life had been cluttered, my to-do list bulging and spilling black sludge. I needed time to be without doing, time to allow my conscious mind to be quiet, time to remember who I was. I'm not alone. I've met so many people who feel a yearning to connect with the natural world and understand its healing wisdom. Like I was, many are grappling with depression and burnout and are struggling to find meaning in a world where so much emphasis is put on amassing material wealth, frequently at the cost of the health of the natural world. The tame world can distort our priorities, leading us to place too much importance on gratifying our egos. But in cultures that respect their connection to the wild, no one individual is more important than the other. When a San hunter brings a big animal home to feed the village, the people tease him. Why did you even bother? Why'd you bring us this old bag of bones? They do this because they know the ego is a dangerous thing. When our tame world egos and desires grow too big, we begin to fight with one another, and we devour our home, our mother, our sanctuary. Like many parents, I worry for my child's future. But when I slip into the green-blue water or walk a wild shore, I feel a deep excitement that soothes my mind. In the water, wild animals have been my greatest teachers. I lie still in the water, keep my body ultra-relaxed, and I wait, sometimes for days, weeks, months, sometimes years. I do this every day for at least an hour, and then suddenly all the dots line up. It's like a looking glass into a secret world. I'm inside of wild nature, speaking in the old way. My whole being is lit up and sparking. It feels like my whole ecosystem is woven into the natural world, woven by water. The animals teach me how to move my body, how to reduce my pressure waves and not trigger the delicate alarm systems in the sea forest. They teach me to relax every muscle, as many animals can measure that muscle tension. They teach me not to kick up sediment, but they also teach me empathy and patience, and they teach me the deep love for my big mother, nature herself. They teach me a sense of community. They teach me not to scare the little guys who tell the big sharks to wake up. They teach me how to flow with the force of the water, to be so grateful for life, to feel intense joy, to feel that I'm made of the same stuff as them, to feel part of my mother. And above all, they've helped me to remember who I am and to be so grateful for the life force of the natural world that rejuvenates and heals us. Fourth insight, we can befriend our primal fears. My desire to be close to wildness has always beaten out my primal fears of things like dark caves, rough waters, and dangerous predators. For me, managing fear is all about getting to know whatever it is you're afraid of. It's also about getting to know your limits. Most fear is of the unknown, after all. Get to the root of some of our species' most common fears and you'll find intelligence there, a brilliant survival mechanism that helped wild people and animals survive. Consider a fear of deep water. The sea can be very dangerous, so there is wisdom in approaching her with caution. Once you understand her ebbs and flows, however, you can make decisions that factor in the force of the wind and tides, the temperature of the air and water, as well as your own strength and energy levels. I don't believe we can chase our primal fears away or deny them any more than we can stop the waves from crashing against the shore or tell a cat not to hiss when her tail is caught under a branch. But we can befriend the primal mind, speak to it in a way you might your beloved dog who barks at a visitor. Now if I feel my heart start to race when I enter the dark, cold water, I will scan my surroundings to make sure there are no real threats, then say to myself, thank you, but there's nothing to worry about today. This is a way of speaking across time to our ancestors, but who also knew a kind of life that our tame modern world has tried to snuff out. I've been privileged to work alongside scientists who've spent their lives studying our deep ancestors. Our coast here is one of the world's greatest hotspots for Middle Stone Age archaeology. Here I've photographed the oldest art and science on Earth and learnt a deep sense of our forebears' lives. I've held the shells and bones, remains of their last meals in my hands from 100,000 years ago. I've sensed their joys and their fears, and I draw courage to face my own fear as I marvel at the incredible path they've walked, which has brought us here to live today. Fifth insight, wildness can be gentle and cooperative. Over a decade spent nurturing my amphibious soul has given me confidence in humanity's ability to build a society more in harmony with wild nature. This stands in contrast to a lot of the conversation around humanity, which seems to take as its premise that we are essentially a bad species, that we are violent and selfish, and that only the veneer of civilization keeps us from killing one another. The daily news certainly supports this idea, yet the science in many ways may point to something quite different. Throughout all of the Middle Stone Age archaeology, there's little evidence that points to interpersonal or intergroup violence. I have the strong sense that we come from a non-violent origin. It was only with the advent of agriculture that the reciprocity with the wild we'd enjoyed for some 300,000 years began to break apart, and with it our psyches. The vibrant umbilical cord that connected our ancestors to the wild was severed, and this break has been traumatic. And what happens when animals are traumatized? They often become violent. I think back to one encounter I had with a southern right whale, the way she lashed out when she felt trapped between us and a large rock. I remember also how the whale returned to me after the initial shock and was gentle, almost apologetic. Even under huge stress, humans too have the capacity to act from our gentle nature. While sometimes humans can be very cruel, I'm always heartened when I think about ecological justice efforts around the globe. So many human beings are recognizing we have an important role to play when it comes to answering the calls of our wild kin. Our best space-age technology pales in comparison to the natural technology that allows an insect or bird to fly on a tiny drop of nectar. This ecological intelligence works hard to maintain itself, to create biodiversity, and to keep temperature and humidity within life-supporting limits. Yet our childlike species today forgets what our ancestors knew well, that we are woven into this delicate balance, and that biodiversity is our life support system. Business and industry leaders in particular, and the officials who support them, seem to have forgotten that the bedrock of their establishments is actually nature itself, and she allows their companies to function. Obsessed with short-term profit, they consume and plunder irreplaceable resources, our planet's ancient forests and wetlands, its wild rivers and oceans. If biodiversity collapses, all their future investments will be worth nothing. We stand on the shoulders of our deep ancestors, and this 3-million-year-old lineage of survival and deep reciprocity with nature gives me hope that we can remember who we are and reunite with our original mother and regenerate our biological life support system. Thank you so much for listening. I hope you enjoy the book and feel the deep joy of sensing your amphibious soul.
Thank you, Craig. That was Craig Foster with 5 Big Ideas from Amphibious Soul, Finding the Wild in a Tame World. Also check out our book bite for Many Things Under a Rock, The Mysteries of Octopuses by David Scheele. I'm Michael Kovnat. Have a great day.